a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Welcome to another edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. My name is Cam Edwards. Appreciate you could join me on the program today. We're going to be talking with Matthew Cavadon here in just a moment or two. He is with Cato Institute's, I guess he heads up Cato Institute's, a project on criminal justice, has a op-ed out talking about Jeanine Pirro's two-step pirouette on the Second Amendment. Before we get to that, though, obviously we do need to address the 800-pound anti-gun gorilla in the room, and that is what Virginia Governor Abigail Spanberger did with the gun control bills that have been sitting on her desk. Midnight last night was the deadline for the governor to act, and in many cases, including the case of the gun and magazine ban that was sent to Spanberger, she did not sign the bill into law, she did not veto the bill, she did not sit on the bill and allow it to become law without her signature. Instead, she proposed amendments to this legislation, kicking it back to the General Assembly, who will meet on April 22nd. Now, that is the day after a referendum takes place in Virginia that would give the Democrats the opportunity to gerrymander our congressional districts and provide them with a 10-1 advantage in our congressional representation. And we had talked about the idea that Spanberger might do this. She did not want, and I don't think any Democrat wants headlines about, you know, governor bans guns a week before the election day. Polling shows, most polling, I should say, shows this is going to be a very tight referendum. I've seen a couple of polls within the margin of error, one that had the referendum winning by, you know, just a couple of points, another one having it defeated by just a couple of points. So I think this was a political move by the governor to try to keep those headlines from appearing over the next a week or so. As to the actual changes, we don't have the text for some of the governor's proposed changes. We did see the release of the governor's substitute bill for the gun and magazine ban. The Reload, Stephen Gutowski, flagged a new definition of an assault firearm offered by the governor. And this would be any centerfire rifle or pistol with a magazine capacity of more than 15 rounds. Not a fixed magazine capacity, but apparently your Glock could magically become an assault firearm if you put a 17-round magazine in it. Put a 10-round magazine in it, you're fine. But 17 rounds, oh no, all of a sudden that's an assault firearm. Now, this language does not ban the possession of so-called assault firearms, but other bills do ban the possession of assault firearms, at least in certain localities and in certain areas of those localities. So this really could trip up gun owners. It would be perfectly, let's say the legislature goes along with Governor Spanberger's changes. The way I read this bill, it would be legal for me to carry a Glock with a 17-round magazine in Farmville. But if I drove to Richmond, Virginia, that gun would automatically become, when I crossed the Richmond city limits, an assault firearm, and I would be committing a crime. Now, you know, there's a pretty good distance between Farmville and Richmond. It's about an hour drive. But the Richmond suburbs of Midlothian, Chesterfield, Henrico, Glen Allen, you know, places that are not within the Richmond city limits, but you cross the street and all of a sudden you're in Richmond. Suburban gun owners could really be, you know, putting their Second Amendment rights and frankly, their freedom at risk simply by carrying a Glock with a standard issue magazine. That's just one of the issues that we have seen. So on tomorrow's program, we're going to do a deep dive into all of the proposed changes that the governor is making. Hopefully by then we'll have the text of all of these proposed changes. Stephen Gutowski is going to be with me on the program tomorrow, so we'll be delving into this in some detail. But I do have a piece at Bearing Arms today. Actually, I've got a couple of pieces talking about what's going on in Virginia. Delegate Wren Williams has put together an article that he is expanding as this language gets released. And he's talking about what changes he has noticed. I've got a link to that at my piece at Bearing Arms. So we are going to be covering this in a great detail. And it's not just because Virginia is where I live. This is ground zero for the gun control movement this year, closely followed by Rhode Island, where, you've got these bills that would ban the possession of so-called assault firearms. So existing owners would have to turn them in, destroy them, or be subject to the police power, in the words of the sponsor of that legislation. But on today's program, we're going to focus in on the U.S. attorney in Washington, D.C., Jeanine Pirro. I've written extensively about Jeanine Pirro over the past couple of months as well, including last week when I wrote a piece at Bearing Arms saying that she should be fired as U.S. attorney for Washington, D.C., because she is impeding progress that is being made in terms of our right to keep and bear arms. You've got the D.C. Court of Appeals that struck down D.C.'s ban on so-called large-capacity magazines, and now U.S. Attorney Pirro is asking the court to basically have a do-over, an en banc review of that decision. She says not to upset the ruling on magazine bans, which there's no other way for this to happen. The en banc court is not going to hold a brand new hearing and not talk about that. That would be the point of having an en banc hearing. She says, though, no, I'm fine with the magazine ban, although there probably is some limit to magazine capacity that would be constitutional. But the U.S. attorney says that what she's really concerned about is how this ruling would impact other gun control laws that she does support, like the district's registration requirements and the requirement that any ammunition that you possess comply with the caliber of the guns that you have registered in the district. Laws that I think most of us would also consider to be violations of our Second Amendment rights. That's what she's actually fighting for by asking for an en banc hearing. It's a mess, put it succinctly. I don't know that Jeanine Pirro is going to be canned as U.S. attorney anytime soon. In fact, as we talked about with our guest today, her name is being bandied about as a potential replacement for Pam Bondi, which I think would be an utter disaster for gun owners. But let's kick off the conversation with Matthew Cavadon. Take a look and a listen. Matthew, thanks so much for coming on the program. I really appreciate your time today.
My pleasure being here. Thank you for the invitation.
Yeah, you bet. And I appreciate you writing about Jeanine Pirro, the U.S. attorney in Washington, D.C. It really has been an extraordinary couple of months for the U.S. attorney. I mean, for all the wrong reasons, I should say. Right. I mean, you've got somebody who, on the one hand, said more than 6 months ago, OK, we're not going to prosecute any lawful gun owner in Washington, D.C. who possesses a large capacity magazine. On the other hand, she has made it clear that even if you possess a concealed carry permit from Virginia or Maryland, if you stray into the district, you can be arrested, you can be charged. She has worked to uphold the district's gun registration and ammunition registration laws. And the latest is, this Benson case where the D.C. Court of Appeals struck down D.C.'s magazine ban. She filed a brief essentially urging the court to go en banc to rehear this case, which would likely result in this ban being overturned, the ban being upheld, a ban that she's not enforcing. But I guess she wants to do this because she's concerned that, that this opinion that struck down the magazine ban would hinder her efforts to, again, enforce the gun registration requirements in the District of Columbia, which, of course, a lot of Second Amendment advocates would have an issue with anyway.
You're absolutely correct. This has been a recurring problem. Jeanine describes herself as a proud, high-heeled gun owner. Some might say she's doing a bit of a two-step on the Second Amendment and has been for a long time. All the way back in 2004, when she was running for Senate up in New York, she said the only reason anybody would have an assault weapon is if they want to kill a lot of people. Fast forward a couple decades, and yeah, we've got her saying after the Alex Preti shooting up in Minnesota, if you bring a gun into the district, I don't care whether you got a license somewhere else, we're going to arrest you, and you'll be lucky if you get the gun back. That causes a bunch of backlash. She then cuts this video, puts it out on social media, talking about how she's a proud, high-heeled gun owner. Gun owners, put your safeties back on. There's nothing to worry about here. And yet, the very next chance that she has to make a big Second Amendment decision, she is trying to snatch defeat from the jaws of victory, Cam. The D.C. Court of Appeals overturned D.C.'s gun magazine limit. I wouldn't have had that in my books for the year.
Right.
That is a pleasant surprise. That's not the federal courts. That's the D.C. local courts. And they're doing this. And yet, she is asking the court to go back, undo that decision, and take another look. She says it's not because she wants the magazine ban to stay in place. But she is willing to roll the dice with four Democratic-appointed judges who didn't hear the case the first time around and see if they can survive the gauntlet again? There's good reasons to be skeptical.
Absolutely. And, you know, not to get too in the legal weeds here, but the panel in Benson, the three-judge panel that ruled this magazine ban unconstitutional, they did throw out additional charges against, I think it's Tyree Benson is his name, for possessing an unregistered firearm, for possessing that unregistered ammunition, because they said he could not have registered that firearm, given the magazine that was, you know, involved with that that gun. Since then, Benson's attorneys have said that this has been remedied so that this no longer will impact. It's been remedied by the Metropolitan Police Department, so the registration requirements no longer will be impacted by, you know, the size of the magazine. In other words, what she's asking for, this rehearing to, you know, preserve these additional laws that I don't think many Second Amendment advocates want to be preserved in the first place. Benson's own attorneys say that's not necessary. You don't need to have a rehearing to do this. This has already been corrected, which again begs the question, what the heck is the U.S. attorney doing here?
Let's go back for a brief moment here to the case of Mr. Benson himself. I worked as a public defender for several years, and it's true anywhere. Impassibility is a defense to a criminal law. So if you truly could not comply with the law, then you can come into court and push back and say, look, I never could have done this. So Tyree says, I never could have registered this firearm because it had a 30-round magazine on it, and the district caps them at 10. What Janine's office said in their legal filing was, well, Tyree could have gone to the police station with this illegal magazine and the gun and could have just had the police seize the magazine but still registered the gun. So it's on him for not going in. I would have loved to have seen how that would have gone for Tyree had he actually tried it, right? I don't think that would have ended very well. He might have registered the gun. He might have also gone to jail. So then there was this whole kerfuffle where the district's attorneys, who work alongside Janine Pirro, but they're a separate office, they came to court and said, look, the entire scheme here is going to be totally unworkable. We don't know what to do. We can't register any guns. The judge who wrote the majority opinion issued a separate order, and he said, with the snap of the fingers, the district could solve this problem by just not taking magazine size into account when they decide whether or not to register firearms. He said, this is ridiculous. This is a manufactured crisis. The district is making up its own problems. And yet, the U.S. Attorney's Office is happy to indulge them and to chime in and say, oh, no, this is far too difficult for enforcement purposes. You pointed out that government, the U.S. government, has not defended this magazine limit for months upon months now. Mm-hmm. So I do not understand what is going on here, other than, again, I don't know if Janine's got some underlying problems with gun rights. I don't know if partially it's a bit of hypocrisy because, frankly, DOJ doesn't like Washingtonians. They vote the wrong way. They don't do things that the government likes beating up on Washingtonians, right? They're big blue city type people. I don't know. It reminds me of a few months ago when the government was saying, when the federal government was saying, well, we should just disarm all the transgender people because they're all too crazy to have guns. You can't have it both ways. You can't have a right, but have it only apply when the government likes the people who decide to exercise it.
Right. Yeah. And you know, I was glad to see that that trial balloon that was floated by a couple of unnamed DOJ officials Was quickly popped, right? I mean, you had virtually every Second Amendment organization come out and say, that's a non-starter, you can't do that. And we've seen that AI quietly dropped, much like Pam Bondi's idea to merge the DEA and the ATF. That got a lot of pushback. I think it is fair to say that, there are some folks within DOJ who I believe do understand the importance and the scope of the right to keep and bear arms. There are those who don't. And unfortunately, I think those internal battles are playing out. You know, my concern is right now you've got an acting Attorney General, Todd Blanche. We don't know who the president is going to name as Pam Bondi's official replacement, but I have seen Jeanine Pirro's name mentioned as a potential replacement, as a potential AG. And I got to tell you, that scares the hell out of me.
These kinds of pirouettes from Pirro about going one way on the Second Amendment and then going the other so far have been Washingtonians' problem. They would become everybody's problem. If she acts this way as the head of the Department of Justice, then every gun owner in the country is going to have to do this. You know, if I told you 2 years ago, Cam, that the director of the FBI and leading DOJ officials would be making statements like, you cannot carry a gun to a protest, or how dare you have one in a way that intimidates a police officer out there, you would think that Kamala Harris must have won the election, right? It is stunning that you have folks like Kash Patel, the director of the FBI, Bill Esaley, who was the top federal prosecutor in Los Angeles, making these kinds of statements. Now, fortunately, Pam Bondi didn't. But can you imagine how much more of a headache it will be if you've got the FBI and the DOJ and a bunch of major city federal prosecutors who are consistently showing up whenever something bad happens and saying it's the gun's fault, we need to put limits on them? You know, there was that brief moment even in the first Trump administration where he said we're going to seize the guns first and go through due process second. Like you said, there have been people who've popped the balloons along the way, and I'm happy about that. It's harder and harder to pop them the closer you are to those levers of power, like being Attorney General.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. And I think that is a valid concern. We already, I think, have a lot of consternation within the Second Amendment community about, the DOJ, broadly upholding most federal gun laws. There was that Office of Legal Counsel opinion about mailing guns to the Postal Service. But DOJ has gone to the mat in defending most gun laws. And that has been problematic. Even the ATF with the pistol brace rule. ATF is continuing, it sounds like, to at least broadly enforce this to some degree, despite DOJ saying, we're not going to do that. This, I think, speaks to the importance of, being watchdogs for our rights. And it doesn't matter if you've got a ostensibly friendly administration or a ostensibly hostile administration. Unfortunately, I think when you talk about the levers of power, I think that there are some public officials who, whether as an issue of expediency or ideology, are willing to throw our right to keep and bear arms under the bus when it is useful to them, right? And certainly we've seen far less of that under this administration than we saw under Joe Biden's watch and under Barack Obama. But I don't think that you can relax your guard or assume that everything's going to work out great because, there is a president with an R after their name in the White House.
You know, it's a mixed bag. And I do want to give credit where it's due, which is Harmeet Dhillon's Office of Civil Rights at the Department of Justice has been really taking on some very creative ways of defending Second Amendment rights. So this is another part of DOJ separate from Jeanine Pirro's office in D.C. But Harmeet has introduced this strategy. Whenever a state or a local government has a bad habit of violating people's rights, the Department of Justice can bring a lawsuit and say you're engaging in a pattern or practice of violating people's rights. In other words, it's not just one or two bad apples. You've got it baked into how you're doing things. You're violating people's rights to be free of surveillance or speech restrictions or whatever it may be. For the first time, DOJ is launching pattern or practice suits on Second Amendment grounds, which is fantastic. It started with Los Angeles, where 4 gun applicants got approved over the course of a year. You had thousands of people applying. You had fewer than 10 were actually approved over the course of a couple of years. And that's great to see the weight of DOJ being brought to defend people's rights rather than to harass them. You know, the irony here is one of the cities DOJ is targeting with a pattern or practice lawsuit is Washington, D.C.
Right.
So you have the district on the one hand getting help from DOJ in defending its one of the strictest gun control regimes in the country. On the other hand, you have another part of DOJ saying this is violating people's civil rights. I would love to see Janine and Harmeet just sit down and work this thing out because it would make things so much simpler.
Yeah, it would. I'd love to see Harmeet Dillon named Attorney General. Honestly, I think you're right. She's been a rock star there at the Civil Rights Division. You counter what she's doing with some of what we've seen from, you know, Maine justice officials or U.S. attorneys around the country. I think the U.S. attorney in Louisiana defending the ban on suppressors at one point saying, well, they're not implicated by the Second Amendment, and then coming back and saying, OK, actually, they are protected by the Second Amendment. But, you know, the $200 tax stamp and the registration requirements, this is just a modest burden on our right to keep and bear arms. The actions of Jeanine Pirro. It is the conflict, I think, between what we're seeing at the Civil Rights Division and some of these U.S. attorneys around the country is frustrating. And, you know, whoever the attorney general is, whether it's, Todd Blanche, whether it's Jeanine Pirro, probably not going to happen if it's Jeanine Pirro, but whoever the next attorney general is, I hope that they can maybe have that sit down and put everybody on the same page, because we've got a couple of years left in the this term of the Trump administration. And I would hate to see the progress that has been made stall out or be countermanded by some of the decisions that we're seeing from U.S. attorneys around the country like Pirro.
I don't agree with Harmeet Dillon on absolutely everything. I will say I do think consistently she's shown a lot of gusto in protecting Second Amendment rights, and I think that's a great feather in her cap. So I will say there are other big fights where who heads the Department of Justice could have a big impact in the next couple of years. This very term, the U.S. Supreme Court is considering whether or not it's constitutional to say that all marijuana users can be disarmed by the federal government, whether that can always be a federal crime. Tens of millions of people at this point use marijuana on an annual basis. Millions upon millions have medical prescriptions for it. The reality of marijuana has changed so much that President Trump actually issued an executive order saying that we should bring it from Schedule 1, which means absolutely banned, down to Schedule 3, which means, well, the prescription, it might be legal to have it at the federal level. But at the same time, you have the Department of Justice right now at the U.S. Supreme Court saying that any habitual user of drugs can be disarmed, and that it can be a federal offense for them to have a gun. Now, what does habitual user mean? The government has not specified that. ATF regulations say it's anybody who's used a drug in the past year can count. But at the same time, DOJ is saying, oh, no, you can stop at any time you want by just stopping being a habitual user. I don't know what they're driving at, and neither could the justices during oral argument. They could not nail down the government as to what they meant. There's also a question about what schedules are we talking about here? The law actually doesn't just say Schedule 1.
Right.
Schedule 3s and 4s? I mean, that's your Adderall. That could be any number of different medications that need a prescription. But the government is still in court saying that your Second Amendment rights do not extend to that, to having even lawful prescribed medications and drugs and guns and ammunition at the same time. There's also another issue that's been percolating in the courts for a long time, which is, can the federal government for life disarm every felon in the country? There was this classic article decades ago called Why Can't Martha Stewart Have a Gun? And the answer is because she engaged in insider trading and she went to Camp Cupcake for it, right? White collar crime. But she's now a felon. Short of a presidential pardon, she can never have a gun or bullets again in her life. And the government has shown a lot of zeal for defending a really broad interpretation of that. The government's gone and fought people with decades-old food stamp fraud convictions from the 1990s who are trying to defend themselves. So, like I said, who is determining priorities at DOJ is going to have a big impact on a lot of Americans.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. I will note that actually the Trump administration did not pursue Range versus Garland up to the Supreme Court. They kind of let that matter drop. But they have said with these 922 G1 cases broadly, hey, look, we've got this rights restoration process that's coming up. We're going to roll it out very soon. So there's no reason for the Supreme Court to get involved here and then strike down the statute because, you know, convicted felons are going to have a way to regain their rights. That doesn't go far enough to me. The statute itself, I think, is problematic. It is overly broad. And you do have cases, you know, whether it's Brian Range, Melinda Vincent, who was convicted of writing a bad check when she was a homeless drug addict 17 years ago. She is now sober. She's a counselor herself. And her petition was recently denied by the Supreme Court. So that's one of the other issues, right? You've got with the DOJ stance, but then you've also got, I think, the Supreme Court's unwillingness at this point to actually address 922 G1. But maybe that could be a topic for another conversation in the future, Matthew. I really appreciate you coming on the program today. You know, hopefully we'll see some good news coming out of DOJ and the U.S. Attorney's Office in D.C. Maybe just some consistency with respect to our right to keep our arms going forward.
I certainly hope so. Thank you very much for fighting the good fight, and I hope that we can chat again soon.
Thanks again. I appreciate Matthew joining us on the program. Looking forward to having him back again soon. All right, before we get to today's Armed Citizen story, our good deed of the day and our recidivist report, I want to talk about this for just a second. From city streets, maybe even the district streets, to mountain trails, your gear should go wherever life takes you. And that's why at Modern Rugged Leather, every bag is handcrafted from premium, responsibly sourced leather. It's designed to look sharp, last long, and tell a story of its own. Every stitch, every buckle, every strap, reflecting timeless craftsmanship. And it's backed by a lifetime warranty, because quality shouldn't quit when the adventure begins. So whether it's the boardroom or the back roads, Modern Rugged Leather helps you carry confidence every step of the way. Modern Rugged Leather. Modern style. Timeless durability. Backed for life. Life takes you places. Make sure your gear keeps up. You can shop the full collection and find yours today at modernrugged.com. Again, that is modernrugged.com. By the way, I normally show you my Modern Rugged bag. I left it over in the house, so I decided not to run back over. But again, I love it. It is big enough. You know, it's amazing. It's like that magic bag of holding if you played Dungeons and Dragons as a kid. So much bigger on the inside than what it looks like on the outside. Every time I'm going somewhere and I need to pack up my laptop, my mouse, my little USB hub, and my, you know, papers, I can fit a book in there, and it's not bulgy or bulky. It's great, and it does hold up. It is absolutely rugged. So again, find yours today at modernrugged.com. All right, on to today's Armed Citizen story, our good deed of the day, and our recidivist report. Let's start there with a case out of Denver, Colorado. Suspect accused of killing man who was walking dog was on probation for a robbery in Logan County. And, you know, I mean, we have seen so many of these stories in Colorado as Democrats continually go after lawful gun owners. They are also making it so much easier for violent offenders to get released early, to get a slap on the wrist. And it sounds like this is what happened here. 22-year-old Kalen Stroder is now facing a charge of first-degree murder in connection with the shooting. Happened on April 9th. And again, man, just walking his dog. Stroder was on probation related to a prior case in Logan County. He was also free on bond while he's facing charges in a separate case in Denver. According to authorities, officers responded to this area on April the 9th on a call about an assault. Someone called 911 shortly before 1 o'clock in the afternoon, reported hearing a woman screaming for a man to get off of her. Multiple other people called 911 and said they saw a man with a gun and then they heard a gunshot. One of the callers said the man, quote, shot someone random. When officers responded, they found the victim lying on the front lawn of a home with a gunshot wound to his head. The witness told police that they saw the man, later identified as Stroder, approach this individual who was walking his dog, heard Stroder say, "What the bleep are you looking at?" and then shoot the man. Court documents obtained by Channel 9 News in Denver show that Stroder was arrested in Logan County in November of 2023. So less than 3 years ago, on charges related to an armed robbery at a home in the town of Sterling, Colorado. Victim reported that three men had broke into his apartment, had stolen his phone, stole his guns. Victim later said that he used to hang out with these suspects. He knew who they were, and they knew who he was. Said that the suspects had previously tried to buy his guns, but he didn't want to sell them. He said that he felt uncomfortable when he was around them. There were several people inside the apartment at the time of the robbery. Other witnesses reported the suspects came in with guns, that the resident was struck in the head with a handgun. Schroeder was taken into custody, along with two other individuals. Multiple weapons were found in the vehicle where Schroeder and these other individuals were stopped, including several firearms that actually did belong to the victim. There was also another gun that had been reported stolen out of Wyoming that was found under one of the seats in the vehicle. So Schroeder was initially charged with aggravated robbery, second-degree burglary, second-degree assault, second-degree motor vehicle theft, menacing, and theft. Again, this is November 2023 when the incident happens. May 19th of last year, so, 11 months ago, Schroeder pleaded guilty to one added count, second-degree burglary. The other six charges were dismissed, and Schroeder was sentenced to 3 years of probation and 90 days in jail. But the 90 days in jail was suspended as a condition of his probation. Less than a week after he resolved those criminal charges with one hell of a plea bargain, Schroeder was arrested in Denver on multiple charges, including harassment, child abuse, assault on a peace officer, and resisting arrest. That case has not yet been resolved, but the arrest in Denver triggered hearings to revoke his probation that he had just received in Logan County, right? You're supposed to keep your nose clean, stay out of trouble. He lasted a week before he was arrested again. But even despite that, his probation was not revoked. Nine News reports that the records show hearings to address the revocation were repeatedly postponed, with the most recent one continued to March the 9th, exactly 1 month before the shooting in Denver. So here you have somebody who was accused of a violent crime, pled down to a single charge of second-degree burglary, walks away with nothing more than probation and a suspended 90-day jail term, is arrested a week later. And again, almost a year after that arrest, his probation has still not even been revoked. Meanwhile, what are Democrats in Denver doing? Oh, we got to register gun barrels. You got to go through a background check if you want to buy a gun barrel. You know what? I think we need to criminalize the dissemination of files that can be used to print gun parts. Right? And don't forget, later this year, the permit to purchase a so-called assault weapon goes into effect. All of these laws aimed at people who are legal, lawful gun owners. And meanwhile, guys like Schroeder, multiple arrests, violent offenses, and not a damn thing happens to them, even when their cases are resolved in the justice system. I can't even call it the justice system, the court system. Because justice isn't being done here. And as a result of Colorado's soft-on-crime policies enacted by the Democrats in the legislature, endorsed by Governor Polis, a man is dead. And the guy who allegedly killed him should have been in prison. But wasn't. Because he got a deal. And he's not the only one. All right. Today's Armed Citizen story. From the Keystone State of Pennsylvania, where a jury has acquitted a man in a daylight shooting of a teenager in downtown Pittsburgh, saying that this individual did, in fact, act in self-defense. Pittsburgh Tribune's Paula Reed Ward reports that 22-year-old Martell Hedges Jr. had alleged all along that he was defending himself on February 19th, 2025, when he fired a single shot He was charged with 4 counts of reckless endangerment, 1 count of aggravated assault. He went on trial last Thursday in Allegheny County Common Pleas Court. Jury, after hearing all of the evidence presented by prosecutors and his defense, deliberated for less than 3 hours before acquitting him. Now, again, we don't know what happened in that jury room, but the fact that it took less than 3 hours for a jury to unanimously conclude that Martell Hedge did not commit a crime but was in fact acting in self-defense, that to me says the evidence against him wasn't that strong to begin with. So according to prosecutors, Hedge was walking down the street in downtown Pittsburgh. It was just about 4 o'clock in the afternoon. He encountered a group of high school students who were waiting at a bus stop. Students told police that Hedge made some comments to them and they, quote, jumped him. According to police, Hedge fought with the teens using his fists, but then later pulled his gun and fired once. When police interviewed Hedge, they noted that he had injuries to his left eye and left hand. Hedge, who's black, told the investigators that while he was waiting at the bus stop that afternoon, the teenagers were acting rowdy, in his words. They were chasing people. One of them, a white teen, kept using racial slurs. Hedge says he initially tried to move away from them. But as that continued, he said he confronted one of them. And then he said the group, quote, just got tough then and started to question and harass him. Two of them allegedly asking Hedge what he was going to do about it and was he prepared to fight. Hedge told police that when he realized, okay, we're about to start throwing punches here, he said he moved his gun. He had a permit to carry, moved his gun from his front right jacket pocket to a holster because he didn't want it to fall during the fight. He wanted to be more secured. And Hedge told officers after he did that, he put up his hands and he started throwing punches. First, he told police the fight only involved 2 of the teens, but then he said others jumped in. Complaint said that he had said he used his weapon because he was being jumped and had to, quote, get them off of me. Hedge told investigators that he fired 1 shot. He immediately dropped the gun and surrendered to police. So I guess the police were there relatively quickly. One teenager was shot, struck in the hip, sustained injuries to his kidney and liver. Hedge was charged March 12th of last year. He was released on an unsecured bond a week later. His defense attorney, Amber Owens, told the jury during closing arguments on Monday there was a clear case of self-defense. And she says the jury vindicated that position. She questioned why the Allegheny County DA's office filed charges in the first place. She said they slapped him first. They proceeded to jump him. It was 3-1. At what point is a license to carry valid if you can't use it? And it's a great question. I don't have a lot of information to go on other than this report. I assume that the DA thought that Hedge was the initial aggressor in this incident. That, maybe he was the one who, started throwing punches first. But it sounds like there was either conflicting testimony about that or no testimony in that regard. Because, again, it doesn't look like this was a difficult decision for the jury in Pittsburgh to come to the conclusion that Martell Hedge was acting in protection of his life when he fired that shot. He was not the actual aggressor in this case. All right, finally today, our good deed of the day. In the right place, at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing. A man from North Vernon, Indiana, who helped save the life of his neighbors just a few days ago. Mike Anderson is his name. And neighbors and officials are calling Mike a hero for going into a burning home and rescuing his neighbors. According to the Jennings County Sheriff's Office, he spoke to a WTHR in Indiana. First responders were on their way to a fire in North Vernon when they were told that the neighbor, Mike Anderson, had gone into that home, which was already filled with flames and heavy smoke, to rescue the elderly couple that lived inside the residence. So when that truck pulled up, medics hopped out. They were able to treat that elderly couple right there because Anderson had managed to pull them to safety. A couple told those medics about Anderson's heroics, which included entering the burning home several times to find and rescue him. Jennings County Sheriff's Chief Deputy Cody Lowe in a Facebook page said, "We are very proud of Mike. If not for him, this may have had a far worse outcome. Mike is a hero today, and we are thankful for him." The couple taken to the local hospital to be treated for smoke inhalation. Sounds like Mike did okay and did not need to be treated, except maybe, you know, treated at the scene. But that truly is heroic. And I mean, again, you know, you look at this picture of Mike and his daughter and maybe his granddaughter. I don't know. But, you know, the selflessness on display here, but putting himself at risk. Mike has loved ones of his own. Would have been really easy to say, "Hey, man, not my responsibility. Know this couple. I'm worried sick, but I'm just gonna stay put until the first responders get here." Mike Anderson didn't do that. Took it upon himself to save those neighbors, and at great risk to himself. So in the right place, at the right time, wasn't able to do the right thing. Mike Anderson, we thank you for your very, very good deed. All right, that is going to do it for this edition of Bearing Arms, Cam & Company. As always, want to thank you for being a part of the program. Looking forward to seeing you back here again tomorrow. Steven Gutowski from The Reload will be with us. We are going to be talking about the spate of Virginia gun control bills and where we go from here now that the governor has recommended changes to several of them. We'll also talk about the bills that Spanberger just signed outright, because there are several of those as well. In the meantime, be sure to check out BearingArms.com throughout the day today, keeping you up to date on all of the latest Second Amendment news and information from all across the nation, including but not limited to what's going on in the Commonwealth of Virginia. If you like what you see, I would also encourage you to become a VIP, VIP Gold, or VIP Platinum member. You get some great benefits no matter what tier of support you choose and no matter what tier of support you decide to participate in. You'll be supporting the work we're doing at Bearing Arms, and I want to thank you for that. Just a reminder, though, VIP Gold and Platinum members, one of the bennies, you get to hang out with Hot Airs at Morrissey and myself every Wednesday, 1:30 Eastern, for our live chat. We'd love for you to be a part of that tomorrow, and hopefully we'll see you there. Until then, be well, be safe, and be free.